Today's episode of Hollywood How Did You Get Here is brought to you by G Technologies, a leading storage solution brand for the entertainment industry. Stay tuned for a special offer from G Technology later on in the show. I'd also like to give a special thanks to our lighting sponsor, LEDGO Technologies, for supporting our show. On today's episode, I get to sit down with friend and filmmaker Steve Holleran, a Southern California boy with a touch of Maine in his blood. Steve got the filmmaking bug early and saw cinematography as a chance to see the world. We'll talk to him about his travels and what it's like to find himself in the middle of a firestorm capturing images for his reality show Fire Chasers. He was also the first DP to get his hands on the Canon C300 Mark III when he shot Boneyard Ballet for the Canon rollout. From reality to theatrical, Steve's been shooting it all. So get comfortable and join me as I sit down with cinematographer Steve Holleran. All right, welcome to the podcast, Stephen. How are you? How have you been?
Good to see you, Tim. Glad to be on today. I've been doing pretty good since I saw you, 6 months ago, the last day of shooting right before the COVID shutdown.
What was it, March?
Yeah, I think so. It was mid to late March. I think we wrapped up our Canon shoot day or two before we locked down. You're the last friendly film face I've seen.
Last set I was on, and we had a hell of a time between COVID and tornado warnings and torrential rain. It was quite the thing. And we're going to get into that a little bit, but we're going to start off by talking about you and how you decided and when you decided you wanted to become a filmmaker. So what took you off the beaches and off your surfboard and said, this is what I want to do for a living?
Well, it was somewhat related to surfing. I got into filmmaking in high school. My mom actually was the one who jump-started it all. She found this article in Outside Magazine about adventure filmmaking, and they had profiled some of the guys that had done Deadliest Catch and the original production's crew, and profiled what it was like to travel the world and shoot in all these different places and the adventures that you'd get to go on. And I was in like the jobs fair at school at the same time trying to figure out what I was going to do and where I wanted to go with my life, and she dropped that in my lap, and it just resonated with me instantly. Here's an opportunity for me to travel the world, bring my surfboards with me. I can surf on my free time. I can make a little bit of money and see the world and meet new and interesting people. And that seemed really enticing to me as a 16-year-old.
Yeah, well, but your dad was a pilot. You could have done that too, you know. Is that where you got the travel bug?
There was always a sense of travel in my family, due to the fact that my dad was always on the road. So he was bouncing around every single American city, and then eventually, you know, he was flying internationally. And I grew up looking at all his charts and mapping out where he was going, because he'd be gone for 4 or 5 days. And you know, as a little kid, you miss your dad a lot. Yeah. when he's gone. So we traveled a lot with him to see family. So there's always a sense that you could get anywhere in the world within 24 hours, and that it wasn't that big of a deal. And that was a blessing, you know, to be in a family that does air travel. So there was that sort of sense of the world's open to explore. And at the same time, you know, I was a big surfer, so I really liked the idea of going to remote destinations and hunting out down great waves, but I didn't really know how I could fund that passion at 16. And then when this Outside Magazine article dropped in my lap, I suddenly realized, hey, I could do both of them together. And so that got me shooting right away. I took my parents' Canon Elf camera, which was one of the earliest digital video cameras, and we bought a $200 housing for it, which was actually pretty good little plastic housing. And I started shooting surf videos with my friends, because I had a bunch of semi-pro surfer buddies, and so I started making surf movies and swimming with them in the water, and started editing all these pieces together. And I started getting a few compliments here and there. Hey, you know, you do a decent job on the edit, and some of the shots look really cool. Can we play your video in our surf shop? And so I got a little exposure like that, and got the bug, and realized, hey, people would pay attention to me if I made videos.
How old are you at this point? Is this high school?
Yeah, I was about 16.
Yeah.
Right around the time the iMac dropped and Final Cut Pro came out. Yeah. And so we had all these digital tools available to us at the time, which made it easy for 16-year-olds to start making videos. So I got really into the idea of making documentaries, and I had a serious passion for the environment, and I wanted to do environmental filmmaking. And so that led me to go to a school called Bowdoin College in Maine. Huh. And it's a liberal arts school, kind of out in the country, out in the woods, a lot of outdoor activities based around that school. And the reason I went there is that I was at a college fair, and the head of the outdoor club at Bowdoin met me, and I told him I wanted to be a filmmaker, and he said, hey, if you come to Bowdoin, I'll buy you a camera and give you a job shooting all of the outing trips. So kayaking trips, ice climbing, snowshoeing, all the things you can imagine would happen in Maine.
Yeah, I grew up summer. There. That's my home state.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've been to Bowdoin, mostly for parties, not for school.
So for me, it was an incredible opportunity to learn on the job and to be a one-man band running, gunning out in the backcountry with a little camera. And for me, I felt like I had already achieved the outside magazine dream. You know, I was doing my form of adventure filmmaking. And so I had a camera in my hand from 16 onwards, and there was one particular thing that pushed me into cinematography, and that was a fellowship that I applied for in my senior year of college called the Watson Fellowship, and it's funded by IBM and Thomas Watson Sr., who served in World War II. He's the son of the founder of IBM. He served in World War II, and when he came back, he realized that we needed to connect the young people of the world so that a massive world war like that would never happen again. If we cross-pollinated cultures and learned about each other, maybe it'd be less likely that we'd have conflicts like that. And so he founded this program, and the program gave 50 scholarships a year to graduating college seniors, funding each of their personal projects. So you could pitch anything. You could pitch, underground cave spelunking. You could pitch an idea to travel the world for a year and look at treehouse building. The only rule with this fellowship was once you took the money, you had to leave August 1st, the year after you graduated, and you couldn't come back to the United States for anything. Funerals, graduations, weddings, it didn't matter. You were on your own, cut off. Shouldn't bring a phone, really shouldn't have any friends or family with you. This is a year about, popping the American bubble and exposing you to different cultures and putting you outside your comfort zone so that when you came back, you're a more enlightened global citizen, I guess. That's the ultimate aim. And so I pitched a documentary, and it was an environmental documentary about overfishing in the South Pacific. And I chose to go to New Zealand to visit the Maori whitefish culture that's there. There's some tribes that still practice traditional fishing. And then I decided to go to Samoa to live with a spearfishing family in a little village on the south coast of Western Samoa. And then my last country I went to was Chile, where I did a similar thing and spent most of my time in the port city of Valparaiso, where I interfaced with local line fishermen. And the idea with the documentary was to expose what, commercial overfishing does to local communities that exists to subside on the local foods that they, get from the water. And so I took a camera and I took my surfboards and I set off for an entire year on my own, getting to do again what the outside magazine had shown me. And so I traveled the world for a year and I shot this film and exposed me to these unique cultures, and I learned new language and I made new friends, and also really challenged me. It was very lonely, and sometimes I just wanted to come home, and sometimes I didn't know what I was doing with the camera. And needless to say, I ended up with two documentaries out of it. One of them, called Samoan Heart, is about the family that I lived with in Samoa that were hit by a tsunami a couple of months after I left, which wiped out the village that I'd lived in. And so I made this retrospective documentary about my experience there with them. And that is the short film that got me into USC to get my master's. Because on the Watson, I realized, hey, I really like this documentary filmmaking experience, but I didn't have enough control. couldn't always get the shots that I wanted. I couldn't light it the way I wanted to. Everything was sort of half-assed. And so I thought, well, I want to go to school to, you know, to be a narrative filmmaker now, to be a cinematographer, so I can control what I'm shooting and get the most perfect shot. So I applied to USC. I got waitlisted, and then one day they called me up and said, "Hey, we got a slot open for you," and I took it. I mean, it was an honor to go there, and so I did the 3-year master program at SC. And the second I got there, you know, I had a ton of camera experience under my belt. You know, I'd shot some other things after I came back from the Watson and was applying to USC. Like I worked at the Del Mar Racetrack, and I shot all the horse racing there for a season. I was a tower camera operator. I worked for a local community news station ingesting Betacam tapes. So they gave me just buckets and buckets of old news tape, and I had to sit there in front of the computer all day and just log in and digitize this material, which was terribly boring, but it did teach me that I didn't want to sit in a room. I knew I probably wasn't going to be an editor. So I got to USC. I had a ton of camera experience, and I made my first short, and it was like an instantaneous reaction in the class that, "Oh, Steve's the cinematographer of our year." And so everybody started asking me to shoot their movies. And so, you know, I ended up DPing every weekend while I was at school. And by my last year, I knew that I wanted to break out into Hollywood itself and try to make my way as an indie cinematographer, which is a whole other journey in itself.
Let me ask you about USC.
Yeah.
And the school system. First of all, it's one of the most prestigious film schools in the world. No, hands down, one of the best. But I hear a lot about the people you meet in college, the people you meet at USC, are the most important contacts you have when you're out of USC. Is that still true? I mean, do you still go to your college buddies for ACs and operators, and or do you kind of get separated after a while?
I would say that it's very true, at least in terms of my experience at USC. And I don't necessarily have college friends that operate for me anymore or assist me. It really was quite the opposite. I ended up making close friends with a couple filmmakers that became very successful. One of them is a good friend of mine, Stephen Capel, and he and I shot a short film called The Land of Misfits while we were at USC, and he had written a feature version of that called The Land, which eventually went on to be our debut feature that went to Sundance and launched our careers and took him on to Creed 2. And another friend of mine, Sev Ohanian, has done incredible producing work. He did Searching, the Sony Pictures classic movie that just blew up internationally last year. And so I met those guys at school, and we were just like-minded kindred spirits, and we wanted to make all of our films together. And so I can look back and say that my career has had a connection to USC pretty much every way I've turned.
So were you both on Creed 2? That was what, Kramer, Morgenthau?
Yeah, so DP? Kramer and was second Kramer unit? Shot the main unit, and I shot the second unit for that.
And then your friend from school, what was his? Did you say you both went on to Creed 2?
Yeah, so Stephen Capel directed Creed 2.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I always look at the credits. I look at DPs. I wandered to the directors later. So
So he went from The Land to Creed 2 and was able to bring me on to do a bunch of second unit work, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounded like it would have been a fun film. All right, so you've done theatrical, you've done doc, you've done reality. I think the first thing I saw that you did was Fire Chasers, which I forget whether that was what network that was, but
it's Netflix.
Netflix, okay, Fire Chasers, which was truly a reality environment. I think a lot of people have seen it. It was a very popular show, and you ended up in some really difficult places. What prepared you for that? Are you an adrenaline junkie? What is it that makes you want to take on something like that?
Well, to be completely honest, at the time, I needed a job. And I had shot The Land and had gone to Sundance, And I had signed with my first agent, and, you know, for a young cinematographer, that's like the holy grail. You think you've made it, but then I didn't have any work. No work was coming in, and then out of the blue, this documentary series, Fire Chasers, showed up, and they wanted to meet me, and I went into Appian Way, and I met, you know, all DiCaprio's people and the director, Julian, and we hit it off, and I pitched them this sort of epic, sweeping IMAX visuals. I mean, the best we could do on the budget that we had, I pitched them a style like that, and they liked it. So I got the job, and I'd grown up near fires, but I knew nothing about them. I didn't know anything about how to get a camera crew or how to immerse cameras into these different fire environments we were shooting in. But I knew the one thing that the director and I knew we wanted to do was get the cameras as up close and personal as possible to the fires, which turned out to be a strong part of the show and also a very dangerous part.
It put our lives in danger
a few times.
Yeah, I mean, it's not theatrical, it's reality, and the cameras are right in the middle of it. You know, it's one thing to shoot a drama about fires and it's all controlled, we got a million people standing around taking care of everything, but it's different with that show. And I think that's probably what I liked about it. But it's also the kind of stuff that you think, is it worth doing? This is just dangerous.
Yeah. To answer your question about what prepared me for that, I think the only thing that I had going for me was all of my adventure filmmaking years and all of my surfing and all of my time in the outdoors. I had a good sense of situational awareness, which is a huge thing when you're in a fire environment, because you have smoke and flames and your whole sense of direction gets completely thrown off. And so you have to maintain a good situational awareness and know where your exit points are and where the trucks are and where the fire is coming from. And I think I had a good sense of that. I think it might have saved us a couple times on the shoot.
Did anybody ever get hurt during the series? That you remember? Tell me about a close call.
Yeah, so there are all kinds of general maladies, like aerosolized poison oak was a big one. So poison oak would catch on fire, it gets super heated, and the oil would evaporate into the air, and you'd get it all over your skin. So you'd constantly have poison oak rashes everywhere, which was pretty uncomfortable. You had exploding propane tanks, live rounds that would blow up in houses. You had wild dogs or pit bulls that would just be freaking out because of the fires, and they'd come running out of houses and try to take you down. You had angry landowners pointing guns at you sometimes, because you'd get up into the backcountry and you know, there'd be three houses and the fire engines are protecting two of them, and then there's the third house that's not getting any attention, and that landowner might get really upset about it and point a gun at you, or they might want you off their property, which is what happened to me when I was shooting one time. And that's all very dangerous. But then there's sinkholes and terrain that collapses and big vehicles that can flip and kill you. And then there's the fire itself, which was definitely the scariest part of shooting fire chasers. And there was one particular fire in San Bernardino called the Blue Cut Fire. It started real fast from an engine fire on the I-15, and it burned 60,000 acres in a day, which was a really fast burn. And we were flown down from Northern California from another fire, and we were taken to the head of this fire front, I don't know, like 9 or 10 in the morning the next day. And it was pretty eerie because the I-15's completely shut down, and we just zipped down the freeway, probably doing 110 in the car to get there. And then we go up this dirt road, we probably go up about 10 miles, and there's four of us. The director wasn't there at the time, so it was producer Aram, who's done a bunch of Deadly Sketch stuff, and then a sound guy and our driver, who happened to be a retired firefighter. And so it was the four of us, two cameras. Aram was shooting the other one. And we went up this ravine to a house that was on its own that was getting defended by two engine crews. And so they were spraying it down and cutting away brush. It's mostly chaparral and Joshua trees out there. And the fire front was coming over the ridge to the south of us. And so we were waiting. We were literally put ourselves in a place where we knew the fire was going to come right at us because that's what we needed for the show. But we were told by our CAL FIRE guys that, oh, it's not going to be that dangerous. It's not going to be that bad. But what happened was the winds shifted in a strange way and kicked up the firestorm as it crested the ridge. And it just took off down this ridgeline towards us. And it broke away in another front, cut off the road so we couldn't get out of the road. And then it pinched in on us. And so it burned in all around us and pushed us into this big horse pen, which was the only area that wouldn't burn. Your other option would be to go into the house as the house catches on fire, because it'll burn long enough that you can stay inside until the fire's passed, and then you can get out of the house before the house collapses. That's another way that you can survive a fire, possibly in really dangerous situations. So we were in that kind of situation with about 100-foot flames moving at about 30, 40 miles an hour. Burned our production vehicle to the ground, which was in a safe zone that turned into a deadly zone. You can see it in episode 2, I believe. There's a couple of shots where one of the engines is backing up down a road and there's tons of huge flames billowing behind it. They're trying to get the engine off the road because the engine was going to melt. And our car was right behind that. It was a Suburban with all our Panavision lenses and batteries and all this stuff. And yeah, it melted it to the ground. It was unrecognizable. And so we were there for sheltered in place for about an hour. We got word out to the showrunner in Burbank and Original Productions. They called Netflix. Netflix called CAL FIRE. They tried to get a Black Hawk in to get us out. And they couldn't because of the smoke. And we also said, hey, you know, we're with the two fire crews here, so let's stay with them and, you know, not risk any more lives.
At what point do you start rethinking your life choices? You know, I mean,
at what point?
Yeah,
what?
Do you sit back and think, do you rethink your life choices at this point? I mean, are you like still digging this, or are you just like, you know what, I'm not doing this again?
Yeah, I definitely regretted taking the job that day. And I specifically remember watching this house next to the house that we were defending. There's another house next to it. I remember it catching on fire and a propane tank off-gassing. It's this huge hiss and billowing flames coming out of the roof and a dog's running out of the house. And I turn around and I look down the road and the fire front has cut off the exit. And I'm thinking, wow, I don't know what to do right now. I'm totally out of my element. I can't see a single CAL FIRE guy. I don't know where any of the engines are. The smoke's coming in. There's this huge roaring fire front coming over the ravine, which sounds like a locomotive when it gets close. And I, you know, I got that chill on the back of my neck that, oh, today's the day I'm going to die. And I did what you hear people say they do, which is they think about their family and they think about the people they love, and you get a profound sense of regret, like you've lost this amazing opportunity to keep living, because in my case, I took this really risky job because I needed the work.
Yeah.
And it sounded like we could do something cool with it, which I think we did on some level.
You did. And there's still the cinematographer in you that wants to get those images. So all of that is going through your head at the same time. And then there's this thing that happens if you're a camera operator or a cinematographer, when your eye is to the eye cup, you get this sort of sense of you're not there, you're observing. Mm-hmm. I guess if there's a fire that sounds like a locomotive coming your way, that sort of breaks that reality. But I know I've been there, and you block everything out. There's something about putting your eye to an eye cup that allows you to block out everything that's going on.
That's the hard part about fire chasers. I never felt like I could get the best shots because I was constantly looking over my shoulder for danger. So you could never let yourself get sucked too far into the eyepiece, because cinematic immunity doesn't protect you on a wildfire. You know, if the fire wants you, it takes you. So I had to create a protocol with our Cal Fire chaperones, with our drivers, to someone always had to be with a cameraman who knew fire, who was specifically there for watching the fire, because I just couldn't watch my back well enough, and then I couldn't do my job either. So yeah, it was just a constant challenge. It's probably to date still the hardest job I've ever done. I mean, I lost 15 pounds in a week just from hiking. I didn't have 15 pounds to lose, you know, because you're doing like 8 mile hikes,
yeah,
probably 4,000 or 5,000 feet up and down of elevation gain, and you've got a
you got fire gear, you got camera gear,
yep. Yeah, camera gear, fire gear, yeah, the whole deal. So water and all that, emergency shelters. And
well, let's shift gears a little bit to something else, something a little, let's go to the age of AI. So I watched that just a few days ago, actually, because I knew you were coming on, and I knew you'd shot it, and I really hadn't had a chance to see it yet. It's spectacular, and it's on YouTube, and I suggest if you're listening, you turn it on and you watch it. It's sort of perfect COVID documentary stuff to watch right now, because it's just fascinating. But it's a documentary. We've been talking about a reality and a reality program, and it obviously hugely reality program. How do you prepare between a reality show and a doc show? I mean, what's the huge difference in terms of the way you have to go into it or approach it as a cinematographer?
Yeah, so, you know, the interesting thing is we shot Fire Chasers to be like a documentary, in the sense that we didn't script anything. You know, we just followed the action as it developed, and we found characters that we liked. Age of AI was somewhat similar. We knew we were going to do sit-down interviews, and we knew we were going to meet these interesting characters around the world that were, you know, working with artificial intelligence in different ways. We didn't always know where they were going to be at with their experiment, how successful it was going to be. Were they going to be as prepared? Would they even let us in the room sometimes? Because these people are very protective of their intellectual property, as you can imagine. This is cutting edge stuff. So in that sense, it was kind of the same, because we didn't always know what we were going to get. And sometimes we had to take these scientists and you know, engineers and put them in unique visual environments on the fly. So it was inventing a lot of interesting lighting. It was finding lots of cool backdrops and really boring spaces like offices and labs.
Yeah.
It was trying to make that visually interesting. Was similar to Fire Chasers in a way, but different. And then we had the challenge of trying to personify this invisible hero of the show, which was artificial intelligence.
Yeah,
it's just the programs that run on a computer, and they're no fun to look at on a monitor when you're rolling on them. So we had to figure out how to give it life, and a lot of that came down to how we shot it. And
you killed it, and it's fascinating.
Thanks.
I mean, that there, like in episode one, there's an interview with an artificial baby, which I think is the scientists are built on the model of this, the scientist child.
Yes.
And it's sort of like creep. You can't take your eyes off it. I mean, it's part fascinating, part creepy. But yeah, it certainly drags you in. It didn't feel like I was looking at zeros and ones on a screen. It was, I really wanted to look closer at the screen. So, kudos on that one.
Good.
Yeah. Really liked it.
We used a lot of macro lenses on that shoot, and we tried to put things in prisms and glass and things in front of the lens that gave it sort of a futuristic look that could obscure parts of the frame, make it more magical. We used a lot of colored LED lighting in the background. Most of the LEDs in all the shots I would just tape up when we got to these offices, just to give it some sort of life. And I think that resonates through pretty well in the show.
Yeah, and it's really consistent all the way through. I mean, all those different environments have the same feel, which obviously that's intentional. You know, you're going from country to country and still trying to come back with a similar look to give consistency to the series. So
exactly.
Yeah. All right, so let's go to theatrical. Of late, you've been doing more theatrical stuff. less television, more theatrical. We met on Tundi Johnson. What was the final name of that one?
We met at the ASC Clubhouse showing of The Calling.
Right, the one that Russell Carpenter did that I got to work on.
Yes.
And then the first project that I got to work on with you was, I was going to say Tundi Johnson. Tunde. The Obituary of, it's a long one. What is it?
Yeah, the Obituary of Tunde Johnson.
Tunde Johnson, right. Yes. Which you shot on a Canon C700 in anamorphic, and I'm not positive, but I think you still might be the only one that's ever done that. It presented challenges, and we'll talk a little about that in the tech side when we get after the break. But that was a traditional theatrical that's still making the rounds. Hopefully, it'll be released where we can see it. And I think, if nothing else, I think COVID should be bringing out films that have been sitting around a little bit. I've seen some that are terrible. It was like everything's getting onto Netflix these days because everybody wants something to watch. And I've seen stuff that was spectacular. It was sort of uniquely stuck away. I think this is one they should look at. I don't know what the status of this film is, but it definitely should be something people see. Very traditional, very anamorphic. Tell us a little bit about the storyline, and then tell me a little bit why you thought anamorphic was the way to tell the story.
Yeah, so the story follows this high school kid who is struggling to come out to his family and friends that he's gay, and also has this secret love affair with the main jock at school who also doesn't want to come out to his dad, and so there's this internal repression happening. At the same time, the main character Tunde gets caught in this Groundhog's Day time loop gone bad, where every day he gets murdered in a different way by the police. And so it's a look at police brutality. You know, it's a look at a lot of the social issues that are happening right now in the United States that people are talking about. It's a very timely movie. And knowing that I wanted to, throughout the film, go deeper and deeper into the main character's head as he keeps living through these different deaths. I thought anamorphic would give me this sort of out of body quality with the shallow depth of field and the unique bouquets, and it would distort faces and also the architecture of some of the places I was shooting. I wanted to bend the straight lines. There was a lot of glass and modern architecture in some of the houses we shot in. I wanted to bend all that because I wanted the audience to feel as if they were on the ride with Tunde into his subconscious.
Was there a reference film that you could quote to that one? Was there something that you've, not trying to say you were looking to achieve somebody else's look, but was there certain influences visually that you wanted to bring to it? Is it one of a great anamorphic film that you just always loved and you were trying to get into that, or no?
I didn't have any particular references on that one. I'd say, I think Moonlight had come out a year or two before, and I think that was shot anamorphic, if I remember correctly. That was definitely an influence in retrospect, just through osmosis. But that I came onto that job so late. I came on 8 days before it went into production, that the director and I picked a look really fast, and then that's how it was going to be throughout the movie. So there wasn't a lot of watching films with him and looking at art and going to museums and building this massive lookbook. We chose this subconscious, somewhat twisted, very static looking movie, and went with it.
I mean, it was technically the most challenging look you could have chosen, given the budgets and everything else. I mean, it's an indie, so it's, you know, there's not a lot of money running around, and you chose to shoot raw and you chose to shoot anamorphic. And we'll touch on that on the tech side on the other side of this, about why people make those choices and what you have to do technically for that. But I wanted to talk a little bit also about Boneyard Ballet. Boneyard was a film that I got to work on with you literally up to the minute COVID threw us all into this crazy world. And people can see that. It's all over the web, and it is absolutely beautiful. Now, I'll set it up because it was a project which we came to you and said, we want to shoot this demo film. By we, I mean Canon USA, which is my alma mater, and I was with them at the time. And we came to you and said, look, we've got this great new camera. What do you think? And you came up with this really great idea. Tell me a little bit about how do you come to a corporate kind of, I mean, essentially it's a beautiful commercial for their camera, but it doesn't feel like a commercial. So how does a filmmaker approach something like that where they go, look, this is what I would have done for Storm Fire Chasers, and this is what I would have done for a theatrical, but this is different. So how do you come up with that idea? And let us know what the idea is. Somewhere in a note somewhere, we'll put a link to it so people can see it. But so just tell me about how the idea came around.
Yeah, well, when we talked and you said that Canon wanted to showcase this new camera and the certain things that the technical specs that we needed to show off with the camera, I knew that I had room to make a short film that was a piece of art. And that was my ultimate aim from the very beginning, was not to make something that felt editorial or overly commercial, but to create a standalone experience that could show off all the technical aspects of the camera. And I knew that there was a variety of concepts out in the world that could bridge that gap. And I'd always had a fascination with abandoned airplane boneyards, which is where we ended up shooting this movie, thus the name Boneyard Ballet. And it also had a great appreciation for ballet. And I started thinking, wow, wouldn't it be really cool if I could get a ballerina on the wing of a 747? And I kind of started there as the kernel of the idea, thinking, oh, it'd be spectacular to see her dancing along this wing, and then what if she jumped off the end? And then I started thinking, okay, well, how do we find her at the beginning of the piece, and where do we follow her? And it was an homage to these two different forms of flight that I thought had some sort of visual congruity. And so that's where the idea came from, and I was able to craft it into a 3-minute short that also showcased this brand new camera and what it could do.
So we'll talk about the camera after the break. And you know, maybe now's a good time to do that. So let's do that. Let's go ahead and put our break in here, and then we'll come right back with Steve Holler, and then we'll start talking tech. We'll be right cool. back. Hang in. This week's episode of Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? Is brought to you by G Technology. Since their inception in 2004, G Technology has offered affordable, reliable, high-performance hard drives. This week, in collaboration with G Technology, we're offering listeners of this podcast 10% off G Technology drives when you shop at filmtools.com. All you have to do is enter code Hollywood when you purchase a G Technology drive on filmtools.com. That's HOLLYWOOD to get 10% off G Technology drives from Film Tools. So if you're in the market for some new storage, make sure to head over to Film Tools and use code Hollywood at checkout to get 10% off your next G Technology drive purchase. And now back to the show. All right, we are back with Steve, and we're going to get techie right now. So, Steve, are there too many cameras on the market, too many choices? I mean, Canon came to you to shoot one, so you had no choice. But there's a million cameras, and since COVID started, I think there's 5 more. Is it getting carried away?
I have a split personality when it comes to talking about whether we have too many cameras. On one side, I would say, yes, as a cinematographer, I would just prefer one really great camera and just shoot everything on that. But there's so many different types of productions now, with so many different types of requirements and different schedules and shooting different locations and different environments, that having access to all these different tools is highly useful. So I kind of have a foot in both camps. If I'm going to shoot a feature and I have the money, I'm going to shoot it on the very best camera and only that camera. If, you know, I'm doing a run and gun documentary, I'm probably going to splatter in all kinds of different tools and cameras and lenses to make it happen cost effectively. But I don't pay attention as much to the camera trends anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's changed is that in my career in 30 years, can't even remember how many cameras I introduced into the marketplace. But they were usually quantum leaps in quality and technology. And I think we're getting to the point where I don't think we've maxed out what we can do technically as an industry, but they're not the quantum leaps that they were before. Not really. There's good ones, but it's what we already did. We're sort of doing better now. Resolution got good, and now it's getting a little better. Stabilization got good, and now it's getting better. But it's not like we just introduced stabilization or higher resolution. So I don't know. And then COVID's got me all confused because we were all out of work for a long time, and we're still not all back yet. So I'm just wondering whether or not this is a good time or a bad time to invest in a camera, but it sort of depends, I guess, on what you're doing.
I've always been a proponent of investing in lenses or lights instead of cameras because they go out of style so fast. And I've seen a lot of people burn a lot of cash buying cameras. That being said, if you're in with the right rental houses, or you're in the right market, and you say you buy a phantom camera, like a friend of mine did, and you live in Phoenix and you're the only guy with a phantom camera, you're gonna pay that camera off quick and get a ton of work, and then have this amazing tool to use. But overall, I'm not watching as much what's happening with the cameras, because it's all kind of the same.
Yeah, I've always felt that way. I thought lenses, those are creative choices, and yes, they hang on for years. And there can be creative changes in glass, which I think is coming more and more. But I think the trend in producing more and more cameras has to slow down a little bit. You got to get your money back. You got to put some time into it. You got to get it rented. You got to get it used. Unless you're somebody that's working constantly, lenses are a better investment.
Yeah, it seems like in a lot of cinematography these days, at least stuff I'm doing, it's more about the lensing and the lighting and less about the camera.
Yeah. Oh, well, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish.
The cameras have just gotten to a point where the quality is so good across the board and the resolution is so high that you're often down-resing or dirtying up the image just to get it to the cinematic quality that you want. So I find that that's changed.
All right. Well, that said, let's talk about the Canon C300 Mark II, the piece that we worked with back in March, April. I love that camera. It was something that we worked on. I think they hit all the buttons. They checked off every box. And the right price point for the right application. You made it sing in that environment. I definitely also see it sitting on Fire Chasers 2 kind of thing. Small, lightweight, inexpensive, the ability to have more cameras, more shots. What did you think? I mean, you did great stuff with it.
I thought it was a fabulous camera. I mean, it's the type of camera that I look for. A camera with high resolution that they can shoot different frame rates, that's small, that's light, that can do record in multiple slots, that has, high dynamic range capabilities, great ISO ratings. That's a unicorn camera, and the kind of camera you can field in a lot of different situations, whether narrative or unscripted. And that's where I'd like to see a lot of the camera building going, is to incorporate all the tools into one really awesome, tiny body. Smaller the better, in my opinion, because I just do more things with it.
Yeah, you can always make a small camera big if you need to, and sometimes you need to. Sometimes the cameras have to be bigger for lots of reasons, and then when the ACs get done with them, they're huge anyway. So by the time they put everything on it, they always get that way anyway. I would wonder what you would look for. Your camera choice, is that driven by the story, by the delivery, by the network, by the producers? Who plays into that choice when you're trying to figure out what you should shoot and what you should test for a film?
Well, the network definitely has a spec sheet, so you have to pick a camera off the spec sheet. And usually it's 4K plus delivery now. Mm-hmm. Fire Chasers, for instance, had that requirement, and they wouldn't allow Alexas at the time, and there wasn't the Alexa LF or the 65, so we had to shoot RED. So they have an impact. The producers obviously do in terms of the budget. Some cameras just may put you outside of the budget of your project. The story, I don't find the story and the camera often interact that much anymore. The story and the lenses interact with each other, and then the lens determines often what camera you're going to use. Because if you decide you're shooting large format, well, then you're shooting on a large format camera. So that's generally the route that I've always taken. And then the application of the camera and the situations that you're going to be in. For instance, Fire Chasers was the kind of shoot where I wish I had a camera with internal NDs.
Right.
And I didn't at the time. And I wanted a lightweight camera. You know, I wanted a camera that I could mount on trucks. And so all that determines also what body I'm using. And that impacts the lenses. And sometimes they don't, like, those two things don't get along very well, which is why I'm always looking for the unicorn camera that can do everything that's all very small.
Fire Chasers was one of the early Reds, wasn't it? I don't remember which Red, but one of the early ones.
Yeah, I think we were on Weapons, or what came after the Epic? I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know.
It might have been the, I think it was a 6K model between the Epic and the Weapon, possibly. If there's one in the middle, I forget, but...
To my point about too many cameras, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's very early in Red technology, and some of the color science wasn't perfect. Their motion mount did not work for us in the field. We had crazy blue shifts in when we got down to like a 2.1 ND in the internal and motion mount. But at the same time, the camera was a workhorse that never failed us in the field, and we were shooting in 120, 130 degree temperatures. So. I would have taken the Canon C300 Mark III over that Red camera any day of the week. It just didn't exist.
Honestly, I think that's when we first saw that, I thought that's kind of where the thing would live. It would live in dock and reality, and then certain people would get really creative and it would cross over to more theatrical looking, traditional looking. But I still think it sits really well there. It's a beautiful camera. It really is. The new Red is a beautiful camera too. I can't wait to see it, but I've been locked in my house since it came out. Because it's small, but I'm hearing some really good things about that. Also, Blackmagic just introduced a 12K. And I don't know. You know, it. I'm more of a latitude guy than a resolution guy. I would like to see a sensor have more latitude. I do think that's the one thing that can play into camera choice relative to the story. You know, if you're shooting a very dark, very, you know, you really want that latitude to communicate the story, to get that kind of detail, I think latitude plays in. But, you know, resolution, I don't know if resolution plays for me unless it's a VFX thing. You know, 4K is plenty. So we'll see. Although that new Blackmagic piece, it's getting a lot of attention. It's an interesting camera. So.
Yeah, on the resolution front, I would say a number of things. One of them is that the more clarity you have, the more you can see, the more things you have to hide. Mm-hmm. So if you're shooting in 8K or 12K, you better be watching it on a very good monitor on set so you see what you're actually shooting, not down-res to 1080. And then you need a VFX budget because you're going to be erasing a lot of things that you'd prefer not to see after the fact. At the same time, the high resolution is great for VFX. You know, it can clean up noise, you know, and it's great for future-proofing your work as we move into higher and higher resolutions. So I don't necessarily see it stopping, but it doesn't really matter to me unless there's a specific need for it for visual effects. Yeah.
All right. So last question, and I ask everybody this one. If you could tell somebody to watch one movie and only one movie, what movie would you recommend? What movie is it that you really, that really stuck with you? Maybe it even was the one that said, this is what I want to do for a living. I don't know, but... If somebody came to you and said, look, I'm a 16-year-old kid and I got a surfboard, but I want to get into the business, what movie would you tell them to watch?
It's pretty dark, but that movie for me would be Apocalypse Now.
You're not the first person to say it, but yeah, it's pretty dark.
That movie had a massive impact on me, not only because of the film itself, but the story behind the making of the film. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was adventure filmmaking, probably at its worst and at its finest at the same time in a narrative setting. And the movie is incredibly powerful and incredibly artistic, and to me, one of Coppola's greatest works.
And it holds up. You know, I mean, I could watch that tonight and I wouldn't feel like I was watching a movie from a long time ago.
Exactly.
Because of COVID, I've been watching stuff that goes back, way back, and trying all sorts of things. And some stuff that I love didn't hold up, and some stuff that I don't really remember, I'm watching again. So, yeah, okay, so that goes on my list between now and vaccine time, that one's on my list. So
yeah, when you're feeling up for a very dark evening, put that one on. You know, the last thing I'd say about that is learning about the making of that movie would teach you all the things that could go wrong on a set. So you'd be a little bit more prepared as you're starting out, knowing, oh, wow, a lot of things could go wrong. And you could still make great art out of it if you have the right team and the right amount of perseverance, which it seemed like they did.
And budget. So.
And budget.
I mean,
maybe you're going to put some of your own money in it.
Sort of a combination of those three, but yeah. Good. Well, look, I really appreciate you coming by. Thanks. It's great seeing you again. I think I started this podcast just so I could see my friends. So it worked out great. I am looking forward to having lunch again at some point. With or without a mask, it's on me. Like I said, appreciate you coming by.
It was a pleasure, Tim. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Thanks very much for stopping by. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for sharing this hour with us, and your support is truly appreciated. And special thanks to Steve Holleran for joining me today. The industry is coming back slowly, but it is coming back. If you have an idea for a guest or a story to tell, hit me up on my Facebook page, The Art of the Image with Tim Smith. I'd love to hear from you. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button. It's so important to the continued success of our show. Till next time, be safe, be healthy, and we'll talk to you on the next episode.